Yep, so this is work that I did for my PhD at the University of Nottingham with Jonathan Hirst, but I'm now at the NIMR. And so we've got here three different landscapes that people keep asking me what they are, and I don't know. I guess this is the Grand Canyon. And this is because I just pulled them out of Google Images, so it's kind of testament to how good that is, that I can get three different rugged landscapes fairly easily. And the idea is that we want to know for the whole of protein sequence space what kind of areas are like this, or are we more like this, or are we in the middle? What's it look like? So why might we want to look at molecular evolution of proteins generally? Well, proteins have been designed by the process of evolution, and so this helps us to understand how they might work. And what this talk particularly wants to know about is that what is the kind of large-scale picture of sequence space, and how might this affect how proteins have evolved, and how is this all organized? And the modern sequences and structures of proteins, how has this been affected by this kind of large-scale picture? So if we consider sequence space, which is the set of all possible protein sequences and the structures that they may or indeed may not fold into, and the kind of idea is, wouldn't it be nice if we could have this whole picture of all of sequence space and see what's going on everywhere and how it's all interconnected? Well, there's obviously a large number of possible proteins. So if we just talk about a protein 100 amino acids long, then there's 20 to the 100 possible sequences. And I had this estimate of the number of particles in the universe being 10 to the 88. So we want to look at more possible sequences than there are particles in the universe. So this could be rather tricky. And of course, looking at different protein conformations, Leventhal cooked up this number that there's, for a protein 150 amino acids long, if you have the 5 psi angles and each one restricted to 10 different conformations, then that gives you 10 to the 300 different protein conformations. And if you believe Anfinsen's experiment, then we want to find the global free energy minimum out of all these conformations. And then I say, well, we want to look at all those possible sequences and find the global free energy minimum from them all. And this is obviously not feasible, as I'm sure you're all aware. And that this sequencing and structure comes together to tell it how to perform its task. And as we've seen in a couple of talks this week, then even the determination of that from knowledge of sequence and structure is not easy. So if we can picture sequence space like this, then we've got the kind of set of all possible sequences. And then these are the kind of areas that people have been talking about during the week that we know about the sequences in this area. And through homology modeling, we can kind of branch out a bit further, and we can kind of get substitution matrices and things based on what we know about these areas. But there's kind of complementary questions. It's kind of what's happening in these areas which we don't know anything about. And what is special about the areas that we do know about? So why are proteins found here but not in this area of sequence space? Is it just that this area, they don't fold up at all? Or is it because nature can't design to this area because of whatever reasons, from population dynamics or whatever? And so this is kind of a complementary approach. So this is kind of maybe a bit cute, but I've just moved to London, and if you want to explore a new city, then there's kind of different ways you could picture doing it. So you can start off in an area of some interest, Mill Hill, where the NIMR is, and we can get on a train and the tube and go underground and pop up somewhere else, and we can kind of walk around and see what the streets and the buildings are like around these areas. But this doesn't. This is kind of what people do with known protein sequences. This doesn't really give us a good picture of the lay of the land. And this is not so much an arm-waving argument, but an arm-flapping argument. If we fly up in the air, and we can have a kind of a low-resolution picture, and we can kind of see what the general structure might be, but not necessarily see what the individual buildings look like. So as I said, for the full sequence enumeration of all proteins, this is intractable. And so what we want to do is kind of lower the resolution here. And the other argument is that if we're looking at atomic level data, then this may be too much data, and we kind of get into looking at exceptions from the rules, and this is all very nice, but if we want to determine general principles, then we might want to kind of, we wouldn't be able to see the wood for the trees, and we want to clear this all away and look at this kind of general principles and get this low resolution picture, and from this look at the characteristics of sequence space and the evolutionary landscapes formed on sequence space. So what do I mean by an evolutionary landscape? So this is a kind of an idea that's been around for donkey's years. I guess Sewell Wright knew that the genes were particulate, and they said that you might want to, if you want to evolve from one gene to another, you would have to cross a set of intermediates. So in the language of genes, we can say that we've got our sequence space of all possible sequences, and if we want to get from here to here, we've got to cross a set of intermediates that have all got to be stable, fold up, and do their job, and if they don't, then we can't go that way. Now, you might say, well, recombination and various other effects, and we're kind of, we can graph these things on afterwards to this picture, but for simplicity, we're not looking at that. So we want to cross this set of intermediates, and we can think of two different kinds of evolution: adaptive, where we're doing this hill climbing process and gradually improving our fitness. And there might be neutral drift, where sequences are equally fit and there's no particular reason to choose one over the other. And should a sequence arise in a population, there's a random chance that it might be accepted, even if it's no better. And this process may be very important, may not, and it's kind of slightly controversial still, I guess, but this is one aspect that we can look at as well. So the kind of cartoon diagram of a protein with the side chains grafted on afterwards. And what kind of assumptions do we make about what a protein is that we might want to try and model? Well, it's a bit unfortunate that I follow David Jones's talk about disorganized regions, but I'm saying that a protein has to be folding up to this nice native structure. And I also say that, well, these hydrophobic regions pointing inwards and the polar regions pointing outwards, and that this generally agreed to be the driving force for folding, not certainly not the only thing, but it certainly agreed to be the main contributor to what makes proteins fold. And we might want to bind a ligand in order to be functional. So if you kind of blur your eyes, we can switch this with our model, and you won't notice the difference. So what we do is we say each amino acid, we just say it's a single point on the chain. And each point on the chain can then walk along on a lattice, and this cuts down conformational space. And in this case, this is on a diamond lattice, so tetrahedral lattice formed by the same that's formed in the structure of diamond. And what we say is that we want a two-letter alphabet rather than a 20-letter alphabet, and this lets us then look at all possible sequences. And we say, well, what's the most important thing? Well, hydrophobic and polar. And so the idea is that these red ones are hydrophobic, and they cluster together, and the blue ones sit on the outside. And I've drawn a ligand in here just to indicate where a binding pocket might be. So this is a site that is surrounded by the chain. And so we can say that here the chain can interact with a possible ligand, and we can have some kind of idea of a function. So there are no neutral residues in this model. You can extend the model to larger alphabets and say different charges and neutral residues and so on. There are no residues in between in this model. So the corners are blue. Right, well, I mean, this is not designed to directly correlate with real protein structures, and so we're not trying to model real protein structures and real protein sequences. Instead, we're saying, imagine a protein was like this instead, and in doing that, you lose a little or a lot, depending on your point of view, but in doing so, what this buys us is an ability to look at all the possible sequences and all the possible structures, which is valuable as well.
So what you reject the space with this lower structure model, and then you really will accept certain, let's say, conditions which would be lower structure, higher meaning, whereby you expect to find meaning. Could you then go to a modified model and then explore the sequence there, or you could be asked to continue?
In terms to find real protein structures? So people do lattice modelling, or did do lattice modelling, and then try and refine it out to a real protein structure. I think Mike Levitt used to do that about 10 years ago. I don't know whether he still looks at that now. So I'm not entirely sure how successful that is. I guess probably not very. Sure. Okay. So for a given, this is now, we can choose our different lattices, and for simplicity, this is a square lattice. And if we have hydrophobes that are black and polar residues that are white, then for a given sequence and structure, we can toss up the contacts between hydrophobic residues or hydrophobe and a polar, or polar and a polar, and using a given energy for each of them, we can calculate an energy for this particular structure. So the energy model that we use is that hydrophobic interactions are favourable and others are unfavourable, and so this just gives us the score for the energy. So if we take a given sequence, we can then take we know all possible conformations and the contact maps of them, and so for that we can calculate the energy over all possible conformations. And once we know this density of states, we can say, does it have a non-degenerate lowest energy state that we will say is a native state it folds up into? And the idea is that in order to remove sequences that would definitely not have cooperative folding, although not necessarily to enforce cooperativity, we can remove sequences that don't have a gap of at least one in energy. So minus a sequence with a structure that has energy minus 18. If there's a competing structure with minus 17, then we say this is a competing energy minimum and it won't fold. So it has to be minus 16 or greater. And then we say, does this sequence have a binding pocket? So does it have an area on the lattice that is surrounded by the rest of the protein? And if it does, then we say, great, we count this one as a viable protein model. And then we can keep going, and we can do this for all sequences up to a certain length. If we get a bit further on, then we can start sampling if necessary. So we've got the square lattice and the diamond lattice, so the two lattices that I've looked at. And people look at lots of different lattices, I guess, often with the more exotic lattices that are supposed to better represent protein conformations that you might then try and fold real sequences from. But the nice thing about these two lattices is that they're both four-coordinate, and once we start getting more than four-coordinate lattices, then exhaustive enumeration is too exhausting and takes too much computer time, and I get told off. So then you have to start sampling. But the kind of nice thing here is that we don't have to sample the structure space. We know whether, according to our criteria, whether a sequence will fold. And we define the function from this bindings pocket. So on the, I say three or more residues, it's five or more on the square lattice we define it as, or three or more on the diamond lattice, and we count the number of hydrophobes around the binding pocket. And this is a kind of a model that our protein sequence might be trying to model this non-specific hydrophobic binding. It's one possible model of fitness. That's the one that we use. So in this case, we've got a binding pocket here with a fitness of 2, and this one has a fitness of 5. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You'll have to take my word for it. And we can use this backtracking algorithm so we find all possible walks for a given length. And once we've got all possible walks for a given length, we can compute this contact map, and that's all that we need to know in order to determine an energy. We don't need to know all the structures, and this is quite a considerable saving. So, summary of our model. We want it to fold to what we say is a native structure. We know all the structures, so we know that it folds according to our definition. And we've got a two-letter alphabet, which means that we can know all the sequences. And we define a fitness, which is based on the number of hydrophobes in the most hydrophobic binding pocket. There's some numbers just to give you a feel for how the problem grows as you increase the chain length. So the number of conformations grows quite rapidly, as do these number of contact maps. And these are non-degenerate contact maps, which are those that only have one structure associated with them. So if a protein folds to a degenerate contact map, then it would be trying to fold to two different sequences, we say. So this is for the square lattice. Diamond lattice looks similarly horrible. And so once you get to this level, you can't really go any further, or I couldn't really go any further with my algorithms anyway. And so we can look at all possible sequences, and we can say how many fit our definition of viability. And there's many more that we say fold than do on the 3D lattice. and the 3D lattice I push slightly further using sampling techniques to generate larger collections of sequences. So what does sequence space look like? Well, some sequences we find are clustered together by point mutations into families. And then there's other sequences that are just out there in the middle of nowhere and are isolated. And these individual families, they often contain bottlenecks, i.e. we have two kind of subfamilies that are only weakly connected. And I'll draw a few of these out in the rest of the talk, so we can represent them graphically, where a node is a sequence and an edge is an allowed mutation. Right, so this is the largest family for the 2D model that we found, and family is defined as where we have a sequence that is a viable sequence, and we can make all possible point mutations to it and find all its neighbors, and then we can find all the neighbors of the neighbors. So they don't necessarily have to fold up to the same structure, and they don't have to fold up with the same fitness. The idea is they're just connected regions of sequence space that are all viable sequences according to our definition. And here we indicate by the color what the fitness of the particular sequence is. So we have areas of low fitness and areas of middle fitness and small areas of higher fitness. And so there's a few interesting things that we see. So we see these bottlenecks where this kind of area of sequence space is only weakly connected by this single set of mutations to this larger area. And so the idea is if you start off here, it's difficult but not impossible to get over here. And with this idea that if you're in this area, then you're more mutationally robust because you'll be receiving donated mutations from your neighbours and you'll be donating to them. Whereas if you're out here, any kind of mutation will just kill you. And so if you're here, you'll be favored compared to here, so it's going to be difficult for the population to move over this bottleneck. And these are somewhat common. And we also see what we call neutral nets. So our definition of a neutral net is that it has to fold up and have the same fitness. So these are sequences that have the same fitness. And if you start here, then you've got to go through a process of neutral drift before you're able to get somewhere nice. Right, the symbols on them, I'm not sure what I originally drew on this diagram, I'm afraid, but to ignore the symbols on them, the thing is just the colour. So the colour represents the number of hydrophobes in the binding pockets. And so, so orange is sequences where when they fold up, they only have two hydrophobes around this binding pocket, and then yellow has three. Like green, dark green, and red, having more. And so the idea is that if we consider.
So when you align between them, what does that represent?
That means that there's a single point mutation connecting those two sequences. So from an H to a P, or P to an H on a single position. Okay.
Have you got some where they're covered by the structure? For example, coming out the yellow group, or the same structure?
I did do that, but I don't have it in this talk. So, and this is one of the things that's kind of interesting with as you change the lattice, and what you find is that you end up on the 2D lattice, which is what this is formed from. You have kind of generally small clusters of structures all linked up together. I think the largest family, if you look at structures in this family, is 64, and so there's 713 members, and the largest set of sequences that all fold up to one structure is 64, and so it's reasonably diverse. But I don't have that slide with me.
Can you say
results
are somewhat
different? Yeah. So I'll kind of come on to that later. Okay, so yeah, this is the idea that if we're yellow, which is defined as low, relatively low fitness, and we want to get to red or dark green, which is relatively high fitness, then we've got to drift along these yellow and orange sequences, and the orange is worse than yellow, before we can get there. And so this is going to act as a kind of problem for the evolution to overcome. So this is what I was just saying. There's got to be neutral evolution before we can get to new function. And this is kind of, you can draw an analogy with the protein folding process where you've got an extended chain that has to sample lots of conformations before it can get to the edge of this folding funnel and just collapse into the state of the folded state. I hope that's the current thinking on what protein folding might be like. So this acts as a kind of entropic barrier before we can optimize. So this is the family I just shown you, this largest family, and there's other smaller families, and as we get smaller chain length, the kind of family size gets smaller. There's this kind of anomaly here, which is partly explained that what happens is on the for a lattice model, if you reverse the sequence, then that will also fold up. And what happens here is there's two separate landscapes where you cross over, where you reverse the sequence, and so that means you double your family size, basically, if you can do that. So that's kind of partly explains it. But when I started my PhD, my supervisor had already done this calculation and saw this one and thought that we were going to get some lovely, huge families, and then I started doing it and started getting these numbers.
It's not
Well, it is somewhat. There's this kind of anomaly here. But it's not directly proportional in the 23, and we suddenly get these huge families.
I mean, the thing that comes to mind is 20 equals 4 times 5. You know, so it's one structure there that can form a relatively compact, maximally compact shape on a square lattice.
But the difference, we're not necessarily looking for maximally compact because of the repulsive interactions that we include. And if we go to the three-dimensional diamond lattice, we find smaller families than we get on the two-dimensional lattice. But this looks more kind of like what you might expect, I suppose. So one thing we can say is, what do our landscapes look like in terms of, this is a couple of figures I've stolen from papers without attribution, but if you've got a relatively smooth landscape with some smoothness, then we can optimize. And if you've got something like this, then it's horrible and you'll get trapped on local maximum, you can't go anywhere. And so what we do is, for each sequence, we count the number of neutral mutations, and we count the number of adaptive mutations, where an adaptive mutation changes the number of hydrophobes in the binding pockets, and we compute this ratio. And what we see that as the size of the chain goes up and as the size of the family goes up, generally you see that more neutral mutations are available to a given sequence. And so hopefully we're moving from something like this to something like this. But this is, of course, a double-edged sword, that if you're too rugged, then you can't optimize, but if you're too flat, then you've got nothing to optimize either. But I think a ratio of 3 to 1 is not too bad. So another way to look at ruggedness is to use this idea of autocorrelation, where we start at a random spot on the landscape and we take a random walk around it, and by making non-lethal point mutations. And the idea is we measure the correlation of fitness between those two points, and then we do this many times and average out. And so we see kind of different features depending on the landscape. So some landscapes we get a relatively slow decrease in autocorrelation, and some we get a kind of a faster decrease. And what's also kind of interesting is that for some we have this kind of bumpy structure, and some are very bumpy and some are kind of absolutely smooth. Where I think this comes from is that some landscapes you have areas of different fitness kind of dotted around, and they're more kind of homogenized up. And so if you make a mutation and you go from one fitness to another, that lowers the correlation. But then you're going to make another mutation, and chances are you might go back to the same fitness again. And this means that we're going up and down and up and down in correlation. Whereas if you've got a landscape like this, where we cross over from here and then we wander around here, and the correlation we're not going back to increase the correlation again, or the chance that we do is fairly small. And so this is kind of like having chocolate chip ice cream or two scoops of different flavors. And these give these are two different landscape types that we observe. So another thing we can look at is, there's one of these kind of questions is, what is the largest, how far across sequence space can we span with one of these families that are all linked up together? And what you can do is also consider insertions and deletions as well as point mutations. And so each node here now is a single whole family linked to other families by deletions, insertions, deletion, deletion, insertion. And what we find is that this really considerably makes things bigger, and the landscape becomes much less fragmented if you allow this. And the kind of idea is that some people kind of just look at point mutations, and maybe it might be wise to include this if you're looking at this aspect. Yeah, so if you make a deletion, then you have to look at a shorter random walk. Let's see what it folds up. So this is an idea that was looked at or observed by Bornberg, Bauer and Chan in their lattice model studies, and they took a two-dimensional lattice model, and they looked for families where they all stayed the same, all fold up to the same structure, and they're all connected by, this is a sequence, and then we've got a point mutation, and then we can go to another point mutation, another point mutation. And the idea is this, that we can take the sequence that has the greatest number of allowed point mutations and put him in the middle, and that each, then we can put its neighbours around in a ring around the outside, and the neighbours, the next nearest neighbours in a ring around the outside of that. And the idea is that as we move out, we decrease the stability, or if we move in, we increase it, and you can see these arrows are indicating increased stability, and that we have this funnel structure where we have unstable, and moving to fewer sequences of more stable native state. And since we already have a folding funnel in protein folding, this is kind of a funnel of funnels, and designated a super funnel by them. So what we did was we take individual neutral nets, where we define a neutral net by fitness, not by structure, and we put the most stable one in the center, and then these are its neighbors, and these are its next nearest neighbors, and we find this funnel structure here, so that as you move out, the stability decreases. And what we find is that these, so for any given neutral net, so for this neutral net, it can make two. Any point can only make a mutation here and a mutation here. There's no point on here which will make a mutation across here. And what we find is that this guy, the hub in the middle, he can fulfill all those mutations, and that each hub in the middle can do that. So this neutral net is linked to this one, this one, this one, and this one, and then there's this guy in the middle, and he can do all those himself. And what this is that as we increase the stability, you can make more mutations in the binding pocket without causing the protein to unfold. So this is what I've just said, and the more stable a protein is, you can make more mutations in the binding pocket, and this means that the more stable a protein is, then you start getting more potential for improving fitness by making mutations in your chosen area.
Have you ever plotted the number of connections that a node can make against the number of nodes with that connectivity?
So you mean a graph with seven connections and then frequency of that?
Yeah,
we have kind of looked at this, but I don't have it with me again, but you will find that you have low frequency for large number of mutations, and then there's a lot of these guys on the edge that can kind of make four, and as we get in the towards the middle, then there's a few that can make seven, eight, nine, whatever. So there is a kind of a distribution like that. There's more that can make fewer. Yeah?
Isn't there a bit of support that last statement?
You mean real proteins? I think maybe not, because I think the evidence would have to come from having observed protein sequences that are here and observed protein sequences that are here, assuming that this funnel structure holds for real proteins. And from population dynamic simulations, which I'm going to go into in a bit, you wouldn't really expect to see any of these arising in nature. But that might be interesting if somebody decided to engineer, take a sequence and engineer so it was more stable, and then see whether you can make, then this gives you more opportunity for increasing the rate of catalysis by directed evolution or something like that. Okay, and it's fairly horrible, but this is the largest 151-member family for the 3D lattice, and the idea is that I've plotted arrows for increasing stability, and again, we see these arrows are all pointing inwards. As you go inside the formula, you increase in the stability. So one thing you might want to look at is this question of designability. So if you've got a given structure, how many sequences can we design that will fold up to that structure at their native state? And you can argue about the importance of this for real sequences, but what we're kind of interested in is, can we look at a structure and determine from looking at the structure and not looking at the sequence space, will it be highly designable or not? So that's what I've just said. So what we can look at is the structure space, and specifically the contact maps formed by each structure. Let me just do this for a second. So say we have a target structure that we want to see. We want to design a sequence to fold up for it. And we have competing structures that are reasonably close in that they have similar contact maps. Now, if we have a lot of these with similar contact maps, then we might say, we've got our given structure, we'll put the hydrophobes in the core and we'll put the polar ones around the outside. But if we have lots of competing structures that have similar contact maps, what we'll end up finding is that there's other structures that can fold up, will fold up equally as readily, and so the sequence won't fold up at all. Well, if we move to an area in structure space where our target structure has fewer competing structures that are close in contact map space, then we might find that by putting the hydrophobes in the right place, we can design a sequence that folds up to that structure. And then if we move to an area where there's even fewer competing structures, then what we might find is that we can start zapping our protein with radiation and making mutations. And because there's so few competing structures around, this hydrophobe isn't going to be useful to any of those, the few that are there by the shape of structure space. So the idea is we can make lots of mutations because of the nature of this structure compared to other structures that might be elsewhere in structure space. Sorry? Well, this is, you could take a compact structure and just look at it and say, what do the other contact maps look like that are similar to it? I mean, whatever scheme you like. So what I do, though, is I looked at, so we have a set of 268 structures that we know fold up for the longest 25-mer chain on the 3D lattice. So what I did was to take a set of 268 contact maps selected randomly from a set of known contact maps with the same distribution and number of contacts. And then this red line, this is a log scale here, and this is the average number of contact maps that only have one difference. So either one extra contact or one contact taken away. This is the number with two. So this is, you know, might be a contact taken away and replaced with another contact. And so these ones might be considered to be in the folding funnel if you're so inclined. But as we get further away, we can start looking at ones with, say, five differences. Then on the scale of our lattice models, that's a fairly major change. And so we plot this. And what we then look at is the set of known ones that do fold. And we find that on average, they're more isolated. There's fewer structures that are similar to their structure than the random ones. And then we can look at the set of 12 that have designability of greater than 39. And this is this blue line that comes underneath. And then we can look at the set of 4 with designability greater than 119. And this is this black line underneath. And so progressively, we're getting more and more isolated. And there's been some other people who look at other measurements, and this is kind of in agreement with that. The kind of problems that are made from concluding too much about this is that different alphabets give different designable structures, and that different lattices give different distributions of designability across them. And the reason is this, or I think the reason is this, that for the three-dimensional lattice, what we see is many structures that have high designability, and this means that probably the nature of the space is that there's lots of these situations where we can start mutating the residue because there's so few around in structure space. But on the 2D lattice, what we see is many of these situations, I think, because what the outcome that we get is that there's many sequences that fold up to one. There's many structures that only have one sequence designing them, or two sequences, and there's much fewer that have many sequences designing them. And this is problematic, but I think probably explained by this system. So if we want to examine evolution directly on these landscapes, then we can follow population dynamic simulation. I looked at a deterministic model with the advantage that this would be fairly tractable for the computers, which I've already taken up too much time on. And there's disadvantages to that in that it always converges to the same state, whereas if you've got a random element in a stochastic simulation, you can get different runs. And you get this infinite population kind of smeared out in the landscape, whereas with a stochastic simulation you can have a population of 4 sequences or whatever. So there's advantages and disadvantages, but that's what we chose to do. And so if we look at this 86-member landscape again, then there's some features that might influence evolution on them. We've got a bottleneck here where this area here is connected to this area by only 2 mutations. And we've got a local maximum here, so red is fitter than dark green. And so if we're crossing across here, we've got to go dark green again. And so this could slow us down. And this is the peak here. Purple is the most fit. And this is another local maximum, and this is another local maximum here. So it's actually 3. So if we throw down a population of 1 on one of these nodes and evolve it out and see how long it takes before 99% of the population has made it onto the peak. And because these are deterministic simulations with infinite population, it always gets to the peak. It's just how long does it take. And then we repeat this starting at every different sequence to kind of see how it's distributed over the landscape, the amount of time it takes. And these are average values for each neutral net here. And what we see is that this bottleneck doesn't actually have any effect under our scheme. And the reason for that is because this local maximum is so kind of catastrophic. And that if you start off here, then it's easier to cross the local maximum than it is if you actually start off on it. And we see if you start off here, it's easier again to cross to here without going via these local maxima. So this is kind of interesting way of looking at how the topology of the landscape might affect things. And we can also look at how the rate changes within the neutral net, and the idea is that the hub nodes can make more mutations and so they should evolve a bit faster. And this is another horrible diagram, but just the thing to I've plotted an arrow connecting 2 nodes, and the arrow is the direction of increased rate. Now this is too horrible to look at, so we've got a table instead, that there's 189 of these edges where, as we move towards the hub node, the rate increases, and there's only 24 where it decreases, and 106 where the rate is maintained. So there's a kind of reasonably strong effect. And so this is the final thing that I come on to, that we can then look at the distribution of population as we move from out, from in to out on this funnel. And so if we start at the hub node, then we find that this sequence at the hub is overrepresented, and that as we move out, these are three different families, I calculated it for, and that as we move out, the population for each sequence goes down. But if we sum up over all sequences on a given ring around the hub, around the centre of the superfunnel, then what we find is the distribution of population is shifted away from the hub. So although the sequences at the centre are overrepresented, they're not that overrepresented. The sheer weight of numbers of sequences that are closer to the edge just outcompetes them. And so this is the reason I say that probably in nature you won't see these hyperstable sequences. So I can't really say whether there's any evidence for whether they behave differently or not. So my conclusions, that we've developed this model that allows us to examine some questions about structure, function and evolution, and as we get to larger landscapes, they get bigger and less rugged. As we get to increasing length, the landscapes get bigger and less rugged. And we can observe these features on the landscapes, that even from a simple model, we can generate these interesting features. And the other thing I looked at, can we design good, and the interesting thing is, can we then just look at all contact maps? And certainly on the lattice model, we could conceivably do this. Look at chain of length 30 and search through for a structure that is isolated in contact map space, and then we can design lots of sequences to fold up to it. And it would be kind of, I wonder if anybody knows whether you can do this kind of thing with real protein sequences. And using the population dynamics model, we look at how landscape structure directly affects evolution. And hub nodes are good for increasing the rate of evolution, although we don't necessarily see them in nature. And so this might be something that, if it is true, then could be taken advantage of by people who want to improve the function of proteins. And even our simple model, we can get local maxima that affect the rates, we get bottlenecks. So it's kind of interesting. And this is the work I did for a PhD with Jonathan Hirst, so thanks to him. And this was when I was at the University of Nottingham and was paid for by the BBSRC. Thanks for your attention.
Got a peak that's, and then the neutral evolution over the peak, or you can say they're all equally fit, and we look at the population over the whole landscape and see how it's distributed.
Yeah. So those were for specific families that were.
I told you that. Otherwise, yes. I mean, if you just had one node that was the fittest, then you wouldn't see that distribution. But I think it's fairly safe to do what I did.
A question about the nature model. In the sense, what you do is you assume that if you go in hyperbole, you escape structure. And whereas in fact that's not the case. That's not really this competition. In the residues have to be closed back. It's quite clear that there's extreme limitations on the combination type focus you have. So the selective pressures on your proteins are far, far greater than the crash is in the market. So how can that qualify as your results?
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, people do use high-throughput patterning to try and design proteins. I do know that, but of course they then have a set of hydrophobes and they allow changes, so presumably the packing comes through by them selecting for it rather than being designed in. Yeah, so it would be nice to move to a larger alphabet, and I think if that's where I was going next, that's what I would do, and I would include some other features.
How would you quantify this output? Because I mean, in what one solution, in rival time, in the people who are trying to do protein-protein docking experiments, aggregations, fail, but they cannot pack their side chains effectively.
Yeah.
So if you're if they use your structure to do it, how would you do it on that?
So you mean how would you represent that in the last model? Yeah, I mean that could be tricky. But I think the way what the question really is how does this change what we've seen going from having hydrophobes only to having side chain packing issues as well? And
subset of those hydrophobic residues consistent with packing arrangement.
so that if he could imagine that what he's looking at is movement on one projection on a higher probability plane, but there would be movement on this other projection as well in terms of the hacking constraints, but it wouldn't really affect the dynamics when you're just looking at the hypertrophic constraint. What you're doing is just moving between compatible packing hydrophobes and hydrophobes.
But I would ask what fraction of these hydrophobes can pack.
That would be good.
It is very small. How would it
affect? Right. And that would be so what I said is if they're orthogonal, and so this is assuming that the number of successful ones is roughly independent of other properties in the model.
Also, it's combinatorial in the sense of what all this is affected by what happened previously in your history. So, allowing the at one point is acceptable, but later on, because what's happened in the neighborhood is unacceptable.
Right. So, it wouldn't matter whether or not you have those effects going on. The only question would be, does it change the entropy in terms of the number of compatible hydrophobes or hydrophiles?
Well, it would affect all those transitions, because those transitions are taking place. You can always have this complication within them. Mm-hmm. And you're going from one sequence to the next.
Right. But if you can imagine that if what you're doing is saying, going from a hydrophile with acceptable packing to a hydrophile with acceptable packing, then the definition of what is acceptable may change, but as long as the first approximation of the number of acceptable ones, then the dynamics would be
to fragment the landscape, you mean?
If
you start randomly removing.
So if you remove most of those, and only a tiny number of the first, which is what happened in real.
Mm-hmm. I can say that, and this may or may not be true, that you get smaller landscapes, but as you increase the length of the chain, you would expect them to grow.
In fact, you tend to find that the smaller chains are more
Maybe there's more question, maybe there's a